All of us at the gut level know that things are not what they should be. There's something not quite right, something seriously broken in our world. We're especially aware of this when we look at the headlines, when we're confronted with health issues, strained relationships, problems at work and in our families, when we face addiction and/or depression, whether in ourselves or someone we care about, and when we are engulfed by the terrible loss that comes with the death of a loved one. Brokenness continues to rear its ugly head despite all our efforts to prevent or fix it. Life is full of trials. Deal with one, and another one pops up to take its place. Some trials are chronic, and nothing we do takes them away. And even if we somehow escape the really serious heartbreaking issues, all the self-care programs and products in the world can't stave off death forever. We all have to face that one. Brokenness, including death, are a part of every person's story. Trials are a part of the human condition, part of being human. But they aren't the whole story. Brokenness and death do not have to have the final word. Because of Jesus, they don't have to be the defining themes of anyone's personal story. What do I mean? Remember, I told you that God has a story that's true for every person ever born? A bigger story within which everyone's own personal story is giving meaning and purpose? A point, a reason? And that point, according to God's story, is not brokenness and death. It's hope. God's story, recall, has the power to rewrite those parts of our story that we don't like, the parts we find hurtful and shameful, and the parts we would rather not speak of. And this isn't even the best part. God's story gives every personal story an amazing death-defying ending. Through Jesus, God invites everyone to join their story, no matter how difficult, messed up, or shameful it is, to His. In part one, I talked about the grand sweep of God's story, what God intended for humanity and the mess humans made in choosing not to trust God and to go their own way. I also talked about God's gracious response in setting things right, first through Abraham, then Israel, and finally and decisively through Jesus, God in flesh and bone. In this segment, part two, I'm going to focus on the beginning of the story, God's awesome intention for humanity and all of creation. And in part three, I'm going to talk about how we got into the mess we have now. Parts 2 and 3 go together and are found in the beginning pages of Genesis, the first book of the Bible. So, let's dig in. Like I said, we find the beginning of God's story in Genesis, the first book or writing in the Bible. Quick aside, the Bible is a collection of over 50 writings or books written by a variety of people covering over 1,500 years of human history. That's a long time. The cool thing is that even though each book can stand on its own, each is also part of the unified story that records God's interactions with humanity. The last book in this collection is called Revelation, and it rounds off God's story as it is recorded in the Bible and describes what will happen when Jesus returns. Currently, we are living in the time between Jesus' death and resurrection and His return. Although the most recent book in the Bible was written at the end of the first century AD, God's story continues to unfold in history in light of Jesus and His return, when He will bring about a new earth with new skies and restore God's perfect peace to all of creation. No more brokenness, no more suffering or tears, no more death. a complete reversal and transformation of every wrongdoing and act of evil. Questions like, why do we even need a new earth? Why does God even need to restore his perfect peace? And the most important, why Jesus? Are first addressed in the opening pages of Genesis. Genesis sets the stage for the rest of the story that follows. So it's pretty important. There's a lot in there, and that's why we're going to tackle it in two parts. The beginning chapters of Genesis tell us about how God created the universe, and they talk about God's relationship with creation. Okay, I'm going to be straight. There's a lot of debate about what the beginning of Genesis tells us and doesn't tell us about things like theory of evolution, Earth's timeline, dinosaurs and the fossil record, the Big Bang theory, etc. You may have even heard about some of this stuff. But I'm not going to get into all of that for the simple reason that the account of God's creation of the universe in Genesis doesn't even pretend to be a scientific explanation. There's no such claim made by or in the book itself. People who look at the Genesis creation story as some kind of scientific explanation, they're suffering from genre confusion. It's like taking a poem about the stars and treating it like a page from an astronomy textbook. Like textbooks, poems can express truth about nature and creation. But unlike textbooks, poems use evocative symbolic language. That's what makes a poem a poem. Language that goes beyond dry propositional truth statements like, stars are giant balls of hot gas. I mean, they are, and that's how a book of astronomy would describe them. But poems express other truth statements about stars. Stars are beautiful in addition to being giant balls of hot gas. As a poet would put it, stars are diamonds in the sky. Both statements describe stars. One is not more true than the other. It's a matter of genre, a dry scientific fact versus a poetic word picture. Okay, but what does this have to do with Genesis? As I said, there's no claim made in Genesis to be a scientific textbook. But although there's poetry in there, the whole thing can't be classified as a poem, so what is it? Let's think about this for a minute. Since it describes God's creation of the universe, including humans, this means no human was around to actually see it being done in real time. It's before history. That's just simple logic. So how can the author of Genesis record something that happened way before there were any humans to observe it and record it? Remember I said that God is a person who seeks to be in relationship with us? Well, people speak, and so does God. Before Jesus, God spoke to his prophets and revealed to them things that humans wouldn't know otherwise, things like the truths about God's intention for humanity and his acts of creation. What we find in the first part of Genesis are revealed truths about an amazing God creating an amazing cosmos expressed in human language. Now, trying to talk about God and the stuff he does is a tall order. Think about it. The author recorded something in human words that no human ever saw happen and never will. Even more profound is that the creation story, concerned as it is with God's making of the universe, which is like mind-blowing in itself, is even more concerned with God's relationship with his creation, especially humans. Like I said before, God is a person and it's all about relationships. Well, the tall order just got taller. Think of it this way. God is God, and human words are, well, human. Talking about God is like trying to shove Mount Everest into a Coca-Cola can. It ain't easy. You get what I mean. Another way to look at it is this. Talking about God is like trying to get at the beauty of giant balls of hot gas. Evocative, symbolic language is better at getting the job done. All right, I know what you're thinking. So, if this account of God's creation of the universe is true, what about science and what it says about creation and the origin of life? I mean, how does that fit in? Here's my take. With respect to creation, science is based on the laws of nature that can be observed and measured. Scientists have discovered these laws over time and have applied them to figure out all sorts of things about the universe, like how gravity works and what atoms and molecules are and how they work. And they've applied this knowledge to make all kinds of advances in technology. I mean, we know this. God baked these laws of nature into his creation and then gave us brains big enough to figure them out and apply them. It's part of the creative power that God gave to humans when he made them and appointed them to fill and rule the earth, you know, to create culture. As far as the origin of life, well, the Big Bang Theory is just that, a theory that astronomers claim explains how the universe came into existence from a single point of matter that expanded over time to the size we have now. Now, this event happened before any human being came into existence to see it happen. And then, according to the theories of the origin of life and evolution, all the variety and order of life on the planet Earth emerged from simple, one-celled organisms that evolved over time, again, before any human walked the planet. That's putting it roughly, but there it is in a nutshell. The fossil record is then offered by scientists as proof of these theories. Now look, in my opinion, it takes less faith to believe in a creative, personal God than to believe that the universe came into being from a single point of matter. Where did that single point of matter come from anyway? I'm just asking. Which then somehow, by some chance, became the beautifully ordered universe and complex and diverse planet Earth that we have today. Just think about this for a minute. How did we get from dead matter to a living cell anyway? I'm just asking. I mean, it's just as plausible and even more so that God is the Big Bang who brought the universe into existence and who ordered the timeline of the emergence of life on the planet in his infinite wisdom and according to his very good and very beautiful plan and purpose. He's God, after all. He's both the author of life and the master artist. And look, the universe is crazy beautiful. So, going along with this line of thinking, the theory of evolution, remember, it's a theory, is just humanity's stab at trying to wrap its mind around a God-sized creative event, using the laws of nature and observable evidence. Because science is limited to things that can be measured, it, including the theory of evolution, explains some things, but no legitimate scientist claims that evolution explains everything about the diversity of life. So, science is great, but it's limited because it's a human tool given to us by a gracious, loving God who exists above and outside of the laws of nature as nature's creator. Stuff about God can be revealed to us by God, but God can't be observed and measured by science. All right, Science is good, but limited. And the creation account in Genesis doesn't claim to be a scientific explanation. It's a revelation given to humanity by its creator that's expressed in human words. Remember, talking about God and how he created the universe is like trying to shove Mount Everest into a Coca-Cola can. That being said, it's no surprise that in the Genesis creation story, we find stuff about 7 days, the Garden of Eden, forbidden fruit. By the way, there's no mention of an apple in there. Adam and Eve, the first people, and a crafty talking serpent that deceives the pair into eating the forbidden fruit. A lot of these things have become part of popular culture, and you may have heard about some of them. Now, time to be upfront again. There's a lot of debate about whether the things I just mentioned should be taken literally or not, or to what degree. I invite all of you to read the beginning of Genesis for yourself, with the caveat that it's not a scientific textbook and that it records, in human words, a God-sized creative event and its aftermath. And see for yourself. What I'm going to do is talk about the three major themes that are in the creation story. They're major because they start here, run through all the separate writings in the Bible, and tie God's story into a unified whole. These themes all have to do with God's relationship with his creation and especially with humanity. And they are the answer to the big questions. Why do we even need a new earth? Why does God need to restore his perfect peace? Why do we need Jesus? How does my story fit in? The questions I mentioned at the beginning of part two. All right, here we go. So, according to Genesis, God spoke the universe into existence. Think about that. He spoke the universe into existence. That's a pretty awesome God. What human could ever come up with a God like that? Think about the myths of the ancient Greeks and Romans for a minute. You have to admit, those gods act a lot like us, and they operate pretty much like Marvel superheroes. It's really easy to see how humans dreamed up gods like those. Again, I invite you to read Genesis for yourself. It reads like a poem as God speaks order and beauty into darkness and chaos. It's awesome. Read it. This God is no superhero. He's way beyond that. The crowning moment in this account is God's creation of humanity as male and female, both made in the image of God, both given the charge to fill the earth and to rule over the rest of creation. Wow, humans are made in the image of God. No other creature on the planet is made in God's image. So what's this business about being made in the image of God? Again, lots of debate about this since the Bible doesn't really explain it. It just states it as a fact. Here's my take. Images reflect the original. Looking at the larger context of God's story, being made in the image of God gives humanity a dignity and honor that puts them above the rest of the things created by God. Every human being is made in the image of God, which means that every human being, as a person, has the same dignity and worth as any other person. Since it's not based on anything they own or do, but simply on the fact that God created them as a human being. I'll have more to say about the image later. For now, in God's eyes, every person, no matter who they are, what they do, or what they own, has equal value, whether they're male or female, black or white or brown or whatever. The image of God unifies us all as human beings. It goes above things like race, gender, age, ethnicity, tribal affiliation, etc. It's the big unifier that unites us without canceling all of our glorious and good differences. So God makes humans in his image, and he makes them rulers over creation, and he puts them, of all places, in a garden. Okay, what's this business about a garden? Couple things. First, the person or prophet who wrote this account was an ancient Near Eastern person living thousands of years ago. Remember, this person is putting a God-sized event into human terms. So they're going to choose language that's good at describing these kinds of profound truths. Now, for ancient people, gardens had major significance. In the ancient world, gardens were planted and maintained by wealthy royal figures, you know, kings. Regular folk were too busy raising serious crops to eat, so they could stay alive in a fickle land where droughts and famine were a constant threat. Regular folk were too busy putting food on the table to mess with bougie gardens. Gardens in the ancient Near East were costly to plant and maintain, full of beautiful ornamental trees, including delicious fruit trees. They had to be artificially irrigated, which meant that the person who had one had to have lots of money and lots of help. Second, in the ancient world, gardens were considered sacred spaces where royalty and nobility went to worship. This is important and gets to the heart of what the garden tells us about humans and their relationship to God. So, King God creates this amazing garden full of awesome stuff, basically everything humans need to live well, not just survive, all free for the taking. And he puts the humans in it, and he gives them the job of maintaining it. In addition to this task, remember, God has made them little kings who have the job of filling and ruling, aka creating culture over the rest of the earth. That is the vast space outside of the garden. So the garden is home base, and the success of the second job, filling and ruling the rest of the earth, depends on home base and its power to sustain the mission. In other words, God is at the center of the human mission. He's both mission control and the power source. From the garden, home base, and the mission, the rest of the earth, three major themes about God's relationship with humanity and the rest of creation emerge. Let's unpack it. Theme number one. In the beginning, humanity knows God, who he is, and just as important, who they are in this relationship. The fact that God places the humans in a garden and gives them the job of caring for it points to the fact that human rule over the earth, or its act of creating culture, is centered on God and flows from humans acknowledging him as God. They know him, meaning they know he's God and that he's perfectly good, and they serve or worship him, expressed as maintaining the garden, by carrying out the task of creating culture according to the boundaries he puts in place. Think of it this way. He's the king, capital K, and they're second in command. Here we have the idea of mission control. In the garden, the humans have everything they need to flourish during their mission. Abundant food and security, abundant experience of love, and freedom from shame, suffering, and death. Here we have the idea of the power source. God's perfect peace exists over all creation. There's peace between humans, among animals, and between humans and the rest of creation. No violence, no domination, no predator-prey dynamic, no exploitation, no depression, addiction, or struggles with perfectionism, no mental or emotional issues that stem from feelings of inadequacy. none of the kind of stuff that would cramp the carrying out of the mission. This perfect peace flows from the unbroken relationship humans have with a perfectly good and loving God. This unbroken relationship with its creator is humanity's true identity. They are the beloved of God. They know God, and they know He loves them. So they can trust Him as God. Theme number two. The first theme, knowing God as God and not as Santa Claus, a genie in the bottle, or as a nice idea that can be ignored whenever it's convenient, is closely tied to the second theme. Actually, the first two themes are two sides of the same coin. To know God as God is to trust Him. If you trust He is God and that you are His beloved, then you will trust that He will act like it always and every time with respect to everything and every situation, period. This includes not only trusting that God always has your back and your best interest in mind, but also that He can and will provide for all physical needs, and that He will also take care of emotional needs, things like having a personal worth, a purpose, an identity. So, if we know that He's the source of all things good and trust that He wants the best for us, we will trust the boundaries He puts in place. So we can put theme number two like this. Humans trust that God can and does provide everything necessary for abundant, exuberant life. So they obey Him. We'll get to this obedience stuff in a minute. Before I do, I want to mention the third theme, which is connected to the first two. It goes like this. Because humans know God is perfectly good, theme number one, they trust and obey Him in His goodness, theme number two, so they live in His presence, theme number three. Think of theme number three like this. Humans are in a perfect relationship of peace with God. There's no wall between them and God. He's right there for them, and they know it. Okay, now that that's out of the way, what's with the obedience stuff? First, get all ideas of a crazy, power-hungry dictator pushing people around out of your mind. Nothing like that. Remember, God is good, and humans are His beloved. This is a whole different kind of relationship. Remember, too, trust is not trust unless there's the opportunity not to trust. God freely created human beings so that He could be in relationship with them. And humans, being made in the image of God, have the same freedom to either stay in that relationship or leave. Now, this is really important. It's not enough just to pay lip service to trust. Yeah, I trust you. We all know that lip service is empty. Think of all those times someone has told you they would do something and then either did something else or nothing at all. I mean, that's just irritating. Just saying something won't stand when the rubber hits the road. When the rubber hits the road, you have to act. You have to make a real-life choice to do either A or B. Same in the creation story. The humans are faced with a dilemma that will test whether or not their trust goes deeper than just lip service. Will they trust God enough to do what He says? Will they trust that He has the best intentions for them? Will they trust that He loves them? What will they do when they are given the chance to choose something other than God? What will they do when the rubber hits the road and they have to act? Now, the rubber hits the road in a big way. And enter into the story, into the garden, into the mission to create culture, into this perfect relationship between humans and God, the talking serpent and the forbidden fruit, aka the tree of knowledge of good and evil. This takes us to part three, how humans messed up and what happens as a consequence. I invite you to go to the next part of God's story at GodsStoryYourIdentity.org to learn more about part three, the great mess up. Remember, there's a place for you in God's story. The invitation is open. Jesus is holding out his hands to you. All you have to do is tell him you're sorry for rebelling and turning your back to him and say, "Yes, Jesus, I want to be part of your story. I want to know what it's like to be God's beloved. I'm tired of brokenness having the last word, and I want to know what my true identity is. I don't want death to have the last word. I want to be part of the new earth when you come back." If you would like to hang out with other folks looking to get to know Jesus better, folks wanting to experience God in everyday life, folks who want to hear more about God's story and be part of it, come and see what River of Grace is about. We can connect you with a group of friends on a journey through life together with God.